Georgia's probably going to be the first state I'm going to blow up, and Mr. Kemp and the Secretary of State need to go with it because they're in on the Dominion scam with their last minute purchase or award of a contract to Dominion of $100 million. The State Bureau of Investigation for Georgia ought to be looking into the financial benefits received by Mr. Kemp and the Secretary of State's family about that time. And another benefit Dominion was created to award is what I would call election insurance. That's why Hugo Chavez had it created in the first place. But I also wonder where he got the technology, where it actually came from, because I think it's hammer and scorecard from the CIA.
That was D.C. lawyer Sidney Powell on Saturday, back when she was still one of the three main public faces on President Donald Trump's various legal challenges to his election loss, talking on Newsmax about a conspiracy involving thousands of people, including many notable elected Republicans, to overturn what she described earlier in the interview as a landslide victory for the incumbent president. On Sunday, likely as a result of the outcry from this interview, the Trump campaign released a statement saying, quote, Sidney Powell is practicing law on her own. She is not a member of the Trump legal team. She is also not a lawyer for the president in his personal capacity, unquote. Nothing in there about the Kraken. Hello, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving week. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. Sorry for that extended explainer in the intro, but I wanted to be responsible. I am Matt Welch, joined in the round by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mengu Ward. Gobble, gobble, y'all.
Howdy.
Happy Turkey Day week, everyone. Hey, Matt.
We're going to talk about the aforementioned legal wranglings of the president a bit later in the show. But just wanted to give you a little amuse-bouche up at top. But first, before anything, as teased last week, we're about ready to launch our annual Webathon appeal to you, dearest listeners and readers and viewers of our product, to throw some of your tax-deductible scratch bitcoins and whatnot so that we can continue doing the work that we do. As part of the fun, we here at the Roundtable are going to be fielding your questions. So bring out your fungo bats and hit line drives at us. Email address is podcasts@reason.com. Boxers or briefs, Friedman or Rothbard, Valentine, Michael Smith or Zardos, etc. Send your stumpers to us individually or as a group. We'll answer as best we can in a special Webathon episode. Again, that's podcasts@reason.com. You'll be glad you did. All right,
Matt. I want to point out that at least 50% of this quartet has no idea what a fungo bat is.
Always the entire point of everything.
Shouldn't we just do like a whole segment in which me and Catherine attempt to ascertain what one is from first principles?
You know, that's not the worst idea.
Actually, like I do think we should do a like guess each other's references round. Like that, if we can figure out how to structure that, I would actually be in favor of that.
Well, I think Matt should play Pepper, like a game of Pepper with live questions with readers.
It'd be like those sort of videos of people explaining the plot of Star Wars, having never watched it, kind of thing.
Yeah, or it would be like Kids React.
You're right.
Yeah.
It'd just be like, here's an ancient piece of culture. What do you think it is? And it's like the kid trying to figure out how to open the Walkman, but us and the weird stuff you guys say. I love it. Let's do it.
My 12-year-old recently asked her mom, did you have a Walkman when you were growing up? She was thrilled to discover.
My daughter is currently reading the Babysitter's Club series, but the original ones. A friend of ours sent us.
Oh, the ones that are set at the McMartin Child Care Center?
They're set in my childhood, and tragically we had to have like a little talk because she like popped her head out from behind the book and was like, Mom, what's autism? And I was like, uh-oh, don't learn about it from book from like 1987. Like, let's stop for a minute.
Since we've already derailed this entirely from the beginning, which is good and on brand, but Nick, you'll be glad to know that I re-listened to, just because I had it random artist spinning on a machine, Frank Zappa's terrible song, Bobby Brown. And we don't want to learn about deviant sexuality from 1980s Frank Zappa. That's strong recommendation.
You know, there's a Frank Zappa documentary that's coming out, I think, early 2021 that has gotten a lot of play, the trailer and things. But Zappa, to me, is always the most tragic kind of rock star in that he was good at that, but he really wanted to be a jazz musician or a big band orchestra leader.
And, it's a tragedy. I think that's actually coming out over Thanksgiving, I recall, the Zappa thing. So I'm looking forward to that.
You know, time no longer really matters.
Let's launch right into our tangent, which is before we talk about the exhausting aspects of national politics, let's take a timeout to acknowledge that we're all, especially Nick, but all of us and everyone listening are about to experience a pretty weird Thanksgiving. I mean, it's 2020, so everything's got to be weird. The typical news lead over the weekend went a little something like this, with nationwide coronavirus hospitalizations topping 80,000 and case counts on the cusp of 200,000 a day. Officials and experts are giving their final pleas for caution in the days before Thanksgiving. So we've got a third new COVID vaccine announced today, which is great news and hooray for that. But meanwhile, people are being asked to and are kind of following through on paring down their Thanksgivings, or at least being made to feel guilty about them via finger wagging messages from various politicians and public health period. Just as an example, my family in California is not meeting with one another. It's all kind of sad here in Brooklyn. Everyone's having sort of like siloed Thanksgivings instead of Friendsgivings. It's like Substack. It's the Substack Thanksgiving.
We're having a Substack Thanksgiving.
It is for everybody.
You got to pay to get the good stuff?
Well, exactly, that's right. So I just want to do a spot check of everybody here to see how everyone's Thanksgivings have been edited in the face of coronavirus and Substack and or not. Catherine, what are your how has 2020, the horrors of 2020, affected your Thanksgiving?
Well, I will not be gathering with my extended family as I usually do. I would say that the specific thing that's going to change is my family has a tradition called Cranberry Man. And what we do is we purchase a can of the jellied cranberries, like the kind that are solid, right? No visible berries. You pop the can out intact and then you turn it into a little person, you know, sage leaves for hair, olives for eyes. I don't know. That's what we do. It's a tradition. It's super cute. You just immediately disassemble it and eat it because that stuff is delicious. We have purchased separate cans of cranberry for our various households, and we will be Zooming Cranberry Man. There will be at some point a Zoom that will just have like a tiled screen full of cranberry-based creatures. So I will attempt to screenshot that and share it with you all in some form, maybe during our webathon. But Zoom Cranberry Man is the accommodation this year.
Nick, is that the official cry for help? Is this is where we send the X reason editor?
It's a tradition, yo. It's beautiful.
I'm a big fan of jellied cranberry sauce. Can do no wrong. I don't know about putting olives on it, but you know, there's nothing more satisfying than when you get it the can in one piece with that weird suction sound
tip,
at the end.
The tip, by the way, to get it to come ridges, out in one piece, you open one side of the can, and then you have to puncture the other side of the can to release the vacuum of the cranberry. You heard it here first.
Yeah.
Wow. Nick, how are your, are you in defiance are you one of those Steven Crowders saying, you know what?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm actually going around and coughing on people publicly. Now I'm going to be driving up to the Bay Area to have Thanksgiving dinner with my girlfriend's family. And then later in the weekend, I'm going to get together with my own family. So for the first time in at least a couple of years, I'll have basically a full family Thanksgiving. So coronavirus has oddly brought a little bit of domestic bliss back
into
my life.
Well, see, now that's very nice. Suderman, I see on Slack, which I'm not supposed to ever talk about, but you're trying to take Tuesday off. I presume that's to make an entire barrel full of bitters or some cocktail crap for Thanksgiving?
In fact, I started making my Thanksgiving cocktail yesterday.
Incredible.
Wow. Is it a pumpkin thing?
So I've got this newsletter that's coming out now, and I explain what I do every year for Thanksgiving. It is a multi-day process. Usually starts the weekend before Thanksgiving. But no, we're not doing our usual big group gathering this year, which is kind of disappointing. You know, last year at about 6 p.m. on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, so just the night before, we finished the major components of the work on an extended renovation of our house, including a renovation of the kitchen. We built out the bar in the basement. And the idea was, so the following day we had a sort of like, here's the Thanksgiving that we can put together in an afternoon, because in my house, Thanksgiving starts like a week in advance. The actual preparation starts a week in advance. And the discussions about the preparation start in October. It's a very serious thing here. But this year we will not be having a big group, and there's no real way to have the big gang over. And I'm really going to miss serving drinks to a dozen or so people. We are still going to make a turkey. I think we have a 16 pounder coming. For whatever reason, I'm made to understand that is the smallest turkey that comes from the place that makes the acceptable turkeys. So we're going to have an awful lot of turkey. It's going to be a radically downgraded experience in a lot of ways in a year where we had been planning for a couple of years that this would be the year where we really got to do the whole shebang, you know, and because we finally had everything renovated and ready, and we're just not going to be able to do it.
I just want to point out that Nick and I saw the acceptable turkeys open for the Spin Doctors in 1994 at Irvine Meadows, and it's just a real shame what happened to the lead singer.
I like their cover of Zappa's Lumpy Gravy, as a matter of fact, more than anything.
See, this right here, this is like a great candidate for like Catherine. Which ones of those things were real? Like, try to guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Irvine Meadows is the only thing that's ever real.
Lumpy Gravy is extremely real if you've ever had gravy in my parents' house.
Wow. Throwing the parents under the bus like that? Let's also, since we're being frivolous, continue the frivolity. And I want to hear about, besides Cranberry Man, holy crap.
Don't hate.
If anyone has... Yeah? Sorry?
Don't hate, I said. Don't hate on Cranberry Man.
Don't hate. No, I just... I mean a little bit. It just reminds me somehow of the Blair Witch Project in ways that I can't really quite put my finger on or in. What are any like best practices you could recommend for people having their sadsgiving at home, their lockdownsgiving? Or just, you know, if like Nick, they're doing a series of super spreader events, what are some tips? It could be about, you know, one little thing with a recipe that they do super good. It can be obviously a cocktail for Suderman, or it could be like how to not be a Detroit Lions fan in the first place. Catherine, what is your fail safe, or how to not talk about politics ever with anybody, especially your spouse? What is your do you have any tips for Thanksgiving to help everyone get through this?
My tip is like a counter conventional wisdom tip, which is that, you know, people say don't have a lot of hors d'oeuvres because like it's a big meal and you want people to like sit down hungry and eat your big fancy turkey and everything. Strongly disagree. Here's why. You're going to be running behind in a normal year. Like, you're just going to be running behind unless, I suppose, you are the McSuderman household and you've been planning for 6 weeks. And even then, probably you're still running behind.
Oh, we're definitely running behind. Our Thanksgiving dinner never, ever starts within an hour of the planned starting
time. So, like, there's the two types of Thanksgiving households. There's the running behind, and then there's the mom that makes everything so far in advance that it's all just cold, right? Like, there's that mom who exists as well. My view is, like, you got to make the really good charcuterie board sitch. Like, when people roll in, you need, like, artistically folded prosciuttos. You need like some really tasty cheese. You need like a whole nice setup because you need to like keep the masses pacified. And I'm going to be...
I can just verify that Catherine does a really nice cheese board even without a lot of preparation.
That's correct.
Like, you'll...
My cheese board game is strong because I
am... Show up at her house and the cheese board will just like appear with no, obviously she hasn't been working.
So I will be applying this even in the tiny Sadsgiving of this year. Still, you know, the kid version, you could just put like some little chunks of cheddar on there that they can eat. A little bit of grapes. Nobody hates it. It's good. So that's my advice. Big pile of fancy looking stuff on a wooden board. Boom.
Suderman, what is a thing that people should do Thanksgiving to improve the pulling it out?
I mean, obviously, you should start making your Thanksgiving cocktail a full week in advance.
Obviously.
But if you're not going to do that,
when should you start drinking
the Thanksgiving
cocktail? A full week in advance. I mean, you've got to taste it every day to see how it comes out. If you don't want to do the massive cocktail project, I really strongly recommend a good bottle of scotch. And in particular, I recommend Boonevin. I believe I'm pronouncing this correctly. It is spelled it's spelled like Buna Habane, but I believe it is Boonevin. It's an Islay Scotch. The 12-year has these great. Islay Scotches are known for being kind of peaty and smoky. They have a really distinct flavor. There's only a couple of distilleries on this island, but this one actually has a bunch of kind of Thanksgiving-y notes to the flavor. You get in particular a real sort of a raisiny. Like a nutty raisiny flavor out of it, and it's just delicious. It's not cheap, but it's not insanely overpriced. You can get it in most decent liquor stores, and you're gonna eat your turkey dinner, be full for a little while, and then have 2 ounces of scotch. You will enjoy it.
Nick, do you have any life strategies, coping strategies for Thanksgiving?
Two things I'll say. One is I would recommend that people listen to, and I apologize for this self-promotion, but in 2016, I interviewed Rachel Loudon, who is a wow. food anthropologist who taught for a long time at University of Texas, Austin, and wrote a great book in 2013 called Cuisine and Empire. But she has a great riff on how Thanksgiving was designed as a meal that repudiated French and English aristocratic trappings. And that's why it's turkey. It's all of these things that are totally low grade, low preparation. Things like cranberry sauce was seen as the opposite of a well-turned French sauce, which is very involved. Pumpkin pie was easy to make. Things like that. It's a wonderful thing. And I think that is the one way to get through Thanksgiving, especially if you are a Detroit Lions fan, but to embrace the small R Republican virtues that when Thanksgiving was designed as a holiday or became a holiday in 1863 originally, it's a repudiation of class. And that's why everything is served all at once. There's no courses, etc., and you just freaking eat all
except
you can.
Except for Catherine's cheese course.
I get all of that. You guys, you know, you're a different generation. You know, you know, this is the difference between, I don't know, you know, people before and after Reagan or something. But, the other thing I would say is actually, if you're going to drink, the best thing to cut through it, and you can do a French version of this, but I prefer the American version, or I used to prefer the American version of Laird's Applejack, which is the oldest continuously produced liquor in the country. It is a type of apple brandy. And the Norman French in Normandy drink Calvados in order to cut through the fat of their meals. This does the same thing for
$4
a bottle.
If you can find it, don't buy Applejack. Buy Laird's Straight Apple Brandy, which is somewhat higher proof and gives you a... it's by the same company, but it's going to give you a...
It's going to give you a Applejack, and when you can find it in the plastic bottle, then you're really cooking with gas.
Laird's Straight
from
Apple Colts
Neck, New Jersey,
is delicious
where
on
Bruce Springsteen
own.
Used to.
And it also makes great cocktails. You can use it as a base in an alternative version penicillin, for example.
You're putting lipstick on a pig, Peter. You're putting lipstick on a pig. And this is a pig's day, even though we eat
I'm putting lipstick on a beautiful bottle of American brandy.
I didn't anticipate what a rich tableau this question would unleash. And I'm very, very excited by it. Let's do one last round of Thanksgiving-related questions for the assembled. Oh, I should mention what I recommend. There's I don't know if this is a common thing, but it's just that the Welch family thing, which probably is a glimpse into the history of Welch's is that our signature side dish is a cornflakes potato cheese sour cream bake.
That sounds damn fine. Especially, is it powdered potatoes? Is it like flavor buds?
No, I think they use actual potatoes for it. It is so delicious, and you just feel your cholesterol doubling in a very brief period of time. It's a wonderful thing. Google a recipe, see what horrors you didn't realize were existing for decades in the same country that you live in with other people.
This is a good day to check out James Lilac's Gallery of Regrettable Food.
Absolutely
as well,
true.
Which is just an archive of great old recipes.
You just gave me nostalgia for that nostalgia site. Like, it's a whole site devoted to nostalgia for like kind of mid-century aesthetic.
Just awful
abortions.
Luminescent food where, you know, one of the great, I had my mother when I when I left for college, she gave me the Better Homes and Garden cookbook, which had recipes even in the 80s, still had recipes like Hawaiian skewers where you would take brown and serve sausages and grill them for 25 minutes. They're already cooked, and then put them between slices of chunk pineapple from a can and maraschino, the bright red maraschino cherries.
Ooh,
on little toothpicks that look like swords. It's just so great.
Always the regrettable food category. It absolutely depends on cocktail wieners from a can. Mm-hmm. That's just like,
oh,
that's,
as long
that's,
as we are.
That's even get
also, though, they can also be suspended in Jello.
As long please as, do not say true. As long as we are talking about cocktail wieners.
No,
Peter.
I was going to say as long as we're talking about food regrets. My other strategy for getting through the day is go for a run in the morning, folks. Like, spend 1 hour exercising before you get into the part of the day where you consume 4,000 or 5,000 calories in an hour.
Oh, I guess my other conversational strategy is to always have something else you need to be doing. Like, when I got to shift into the like honored female role of hostess and cook, it was like such an improvement of the Thanksgiving scenario for me. Cause like, you know,
cause you were in charge.
Because I was in charge and so I was going to do it right. But also because, you know, the conversation starts to get a little touchy. You're like, oh, I got to check the potatoes. Stand up and walk away. There is no shame in that game. Just do it.
Do any of you put up the Christmas tree, at least if not on Thanksgiving itself, over Thanksgiving weekend? That's a fun thing to do.
No.
Especially if you do it right, by which I mean you go into the attic or the basement and get the artificial tree and then assemble it.
Get the artificial and unfold the little spindly.
It's wonderful.
I will say I'm kind of enjoying, like, in 2020, in this year that time has no meaning, as Nick mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, which was also 6 weeks ago, the beginning of this very podcast. People are like, Christmas is already happening in DC. Like, people have started the Christmas early, and generally I'm a no Christmas carols until after Thanksgiving hardliner, but I am fully issuing a 2020 exception, and I am very much enjoying the people who started Christmas already, and they're just going to keep doing that for weeks.
This is like how they changed the rules for Oscars eligibility this year.
Yes, just like that.
It's that lines up.
Yeah. The other great Thanksgiving thing is read even just the Wikipedia page about Squanto, the Indian who is who's kind of responsible for the whole thing. Just a fantastic story that he met the pilgrims speaking English because he had actually been captured and taken to England, learned English, and then escaped back to the New World. But it's really a really fascinating
just on the on the Christmas tip, I can exclusively report that in JFK, the airport, not the assassinated president, whose anniversary of that day was yesterday, by the way, Nick, as you remember, but that they had Christmas tree decorations, including polar bears and such, in October there, which I thought was terrible. And I'm normally on Team Kennedy, not the assassinated president, but our friend who hosts an eponymous show at Fox Business, about letting the turkey cool before getting into the festive Christmas spirit. However,
the 2020 exception, right?
I have to say that I engaged in a 2020 exception just yesterday whilst driving through upstate New York. I was flipping around, scanning for the radio stations, and I let it sit on the Christmas station for at least like 45 minutes, Catherine.
Oh, wow. What was the worst song that you heard, Matt? Were they doing stuff like, you know, the Kinks' Father Christmas and Bruce Springsteen's Santa Claus Has Come to Town?
No, it was all, you know, let's call the whole thing off. And it's classics.
Yeah.
Very good. All right, one last.
You know, the other, may I ask, or may I suggest also, and it may be too late for many people, but getting a COVID test is always a nice thing to bring.
This podcast, guys.
You know, the certification that you are either, you know, you have it or you don't. The last super spreader event I attended was on Sunday, where I was in a long line for about 2 hours to get a COVID test, even though I have antibodies, et cetera. And I've had like three blood tests. But that's a nice thing to do if you're going to be seeing people, especially if they're in at-risk categories.
Can you make a cranberry man while standing in line to get your COVID test?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. People were grilling, you know.
Maybe we're going to put
one of those things.
I won't get into the details.
Okay. Let's extend this one last round and before getting into news, which is in the spirit of turning our national frown upside down, Nick, for once, I would like to hear from all of us what, outside of our immediate family or very large dogs, are we particularly thankful for in this not-so-awesome year of 2020? Catherine, why don't you lead us? And it can't be about space, though.
I know. I believe me, when you prepped us for this question, I was like, I can't say rockets again.
Well, yeah, I guess I just can. Did, but... And you basically just said rockets. We know that your actual
answer
is rockets.
I want to talk more broadly about all the technological stuff that works. I think the thing that 2020 has made me grateful for, which I was, of course, already primed to be grateful for, but the pre-existing solutions that were out there in the market, because people had already had this idea of a problem they might want to solve, that were ready to be grabbed and ran with when coronavirus hit. So I'm thinking here of Zoom, of course, which long pre-existed COVID, but found its highest purpose. I'm thinking of Amazon. I'm thinking of grocery delivery. The best grocery store ever, Wegmans, has started delivering on its own app. Like that, coronavirus made that possible. So I guess I just want to give like a shout out to the things on the internet that worked okay before COVID and that work better now, both because of the network effects and because the products themselves have actually improved. And I include in that TikTok, which narrowly escaped becoming illegal again last week, hopefully for the last time.
Because the Trump administration forgot.
Because the Trump administration forgot they were trying to make it illegal. But I was reminded as I was scrolling through TikTok that it is like a great, beautiful little object lesson in why there is no such thing as a social media monopoly. Like, I haven't been on Facebook in weeks. I just look at TikTok now and occasionally Instagram. Like, these things evolve and change, and the stuff that works calls to us and makes our lives better. And I am grateful.
Have you not lost your daughter yet to TikTok?
Mm-mm.
So you're
she's still 9. She's little. She don't need no TikToks yet.
Oh, you have no idea.
Why are you interspersing every other word with Chinese language,
that's right,
Catherine? Does that have something to do with TikTok?
The Chi-Com's got me, Nick.
Nick, what besides magic mushrooms are you thankful for in this year of our Lord?
Yeah, this is actually a gigantic year for psychedelics, and which makes total sense in a way that, you know, when you can't kind of explore the outer world, you explore the inner world. And I was just reading an interview with Dr. Bronner, the head of Dr. Bronner Soap, who's a hemp activist, a pot activist. He chucked a ton of money at the Oregon state initiatives to decriminalize all narcotics as well as legalize psilocybin and a couple of other types of plant-based psychedelics. And he did it partly because Bronner Soap is up. They had a record year in 2019. They're up 50% because everybody's washing their hands like all the time. and he funneled it into that. So I think on a kind of crude level, this has, it is resetting certain aspects of not just drug culture, but I think what we can safely openly start talking about is post-prohibitionist America. You know, the marijuana laws are ending, liquor laws, and you know, Peter and other people have written a lot about this. I mean, we have an insane patchwork of literally laws that go back to the colonial period governing the use of liquor and the sale of liquor. All of that is changing in a positive way. So, you know, I do think there is going to be long-term damage because of the increase in drinking in particular, but it's really, I think coronavirus and the lockdown has changed the way we think about intoxicants. And that in general is good, even if you don't partake in any of these things, because the kind of secondary and tertiary effects of all of this are that, you know, the police will stop policing people who are making, you know, who are doing no harm to anybody except possibly themselves. So that's a win.
Peter, I think you just got to go 3 for 3, staying on brand with what you're thankful for. So go right ahead.
I mean, I have two answers. The first one is a sort of glib answer.
Already on brand.
Which is that, like, yeah, I mean, I'm thankful for the universe of in-home entertainment. This has been, in many ways, a kind of crappy year, certainly a very weird one. I have been at home much, much more than I am used to. But there is just so much stuff of really quite high quality and very low cost that is available. And, you know, you see, I mean, from video games to the, you know, all of these streaming services that have popped online, we've got giant budget movies that were supposed to go to movie theaters coming into our homes. Wonder Woman 1984 is going to end up on HBO Max, which is, if you've had an HBO subscription, you just, for the, I believe nearly everyone, if not everyone in the country who already had an HBO subscription got their, that service converted into an even more expansive streaming service that will now just, you're going to get to go to see Wonder Woman on Christmas Day in your home. And so that sort of thing, you know, we've got the new video game consoles coming out. I finally snagged an order for an Xbox Series X, pretty excited about that. But, you know, so my second answer, though, is along the same lines, which is a sort of more serious technology, right? And that is the bioscience sector. We are less than a year, maybe a year out from the very, very first case of coronavirus being discovered in the world, less than a year from the first case in the United States that we know of. And we have three vaccine candidates, two of which are using brand new technologies, messenger RNA, that appear to be incredibly effective, one of which uses a somewhat older technology, but is much easier to move around because it doesn't require cold storage. So logistically, it's going to just be easier to get to people. It's 70% effective, which is actually quite good for a vaccine and pretty in line with the vaccines historically. We have three vaccine candidates for this thing in under a year. That's incredible. And there's no precedent for anything like that. And the pharmaceutical sector gets all sorts of crap, sometimes for good reason. They are very much bound up in government money, in much the way that much of the healthcare sector is. At the same time, they are also private organizations that do that do business privately. The very first of these vaccine candidates, the R&D portion of it, at least, was done without government money, even though there was effectively a kind of a prize waiting for them of about $2 billion at the end through Operation Warp Speed. And it's just amazing what people can do, what science can do, what humans can invent, and what sort of problems can be solved if we have a compelling reason, as we do in this case.
I will top this off by saying I am thankful for, in a completely sincere way, you all listening to this, and even in a broader kind of sense, the family of reason, donors, supporters, readers, whatever, that make us all employed, which is not a small thing, but also able to kind of pursue this. Nick had a great tweet yesterday or the day before, you know, talking about why he's stoked to be working at Reason in his 27th year. And he did all these incredible interviews just over the past week and then got to write about mushrooms because he's just decided to spend the end of his career just flying on drugs, apparently. No, it's like to be able to work on stuff that is of intellectual interest and also connects with people in the world. This has been people. I haven't had a year where I've interacted more with the people who consume whatever stuff that I and we do in the world than this year. And that's very meaningful. It helps. It hasn't been easy for any of us in our own respective lives. And that interaction I treasure as I get old more than ever. So thank you to all of us. And then we're going to hit you up for lots of money beginning in like 4 days. So get ready for all of that.
And all of that is enabled by off-the-shelf technological solutions. I mean, we're recording this from 4 different locations, you know, using technology that existed pre-coronavirus, but that we have employed to greater extent now that we're all separated.
That nice full circle of Thanksgivingness.
Yeah, but Nick's going to ruin it.
At the risk of extending this. No, well, you know, the other thing, the election issue was titled something along the lines like, it's a shame they both can't lose, right? Or why can't they both lose?
That was my opinion.
And this election actually kind of, you know, delivered on that. Because when you think about it, Trump has been rejected. You know, sorry, Matt, but he's not going to prevail in his lawsuits. But, you know, Trump has been kicked out. But then the Democrats have also been rebuked. They lost houses. They lost seats in the House. They failed to pick up the Senate, as was widely predicted. And at state houses across the country, they've lost seats. You know, this is kind of like, I think the American people are getting to a point where they're just saying no to everything and you can't live there forever. But I think that's also something to be thankful for this year.
Let's use that as an opportunity to pivot to what was teased at the top of this program before the very long and entertaining diversion. Sidney Powell, Legal Theories, the Die Dripper Rudy Giuliani, their putative client Donald J. Trump. Tomorrow, we're recording this on Monday. It's released on Monday, is what we do. Tomorrow, on the Tuesday, will be the 3-week anniversary of the election. This morning, I did something which I haven't done in a very long time, which is check the Twitter feed of the 45th president of the United States. And here's what he said around midnight last night. In certain swing states, there were more votes than people who voted. And in big numbers, does that not really matter? Stopping poll watchers, voting for unsuspecting people, fake ballots, and so much more. Such egregious conduct, we will win, said the president. So he's still not having it, but neither are state election boards. Today, Michigan and Pennsylvania, two key battleground states, were set to certify Joe Biden's victory. Also not having it are judges in like more than 30 court cases by now. They continue to dismiss the president's arguments or his team's arguments with a mixture of prejudice and kind of outright contempt. Here's a quote from a recent one as written up by Jacob Sullum from Pennsylvania. This court has been presented with strained legal arguments without merit and speculative accusations, unpled in the operative complaint and unsupported by the evidence. That was a Republican appointed judge in Pennsylvania. So my general question for the class in the time that we have remaining is, and we'll start with Catherine because she's the boss. What do we think about this behavior, including its sort of support by various Republicans out there in the world? What's the importance of it, if any? What, if anything, does it bode for the future of American politics? Start chewing on this leg of turkey, Catherine.
Okay. So I
give us the crispy skin.
I will give you the crispy skin, and then y'all can dig deeper to the stuffing or something. So I think, you know, this is such a great illustration of what I think of as the Nick Gillespie point, that the less trust people have in government, broadly speaking, the less trust they have in institutions, the more they demand of those institutions, the more they ask their politicians and other powerful players to deliver. And this is what's happening right now, is that we have low trust in a bunch of our institutions, including, with some justice, our election process. And this is something that I've actually struggled with as we've thought about how to cover the Trump campaign's allegations of election fraud, voter fraud, and general misbehavior, is that there is some fraud. There are very small amounts of fraud. It does not look to me, based on what we now have, which is an unprecedentedly large amount of information, about how each of these...
I mean, it's very small. When the Heritage Foundation looked into this, in the last 10 years,
I sure am agreeing with you, Peter.
Less than 500.
Let me finish saying my thing about how I'm agreeing with you, okay? Which is that...
Oh, I know.
It's very small. We agree it's very small. But American elections are not flawlessly conducted. And frankly, they could be better. We have, for many, many cycles, said our elections could be conducted more cleanly, more transparently. We could solve our problem with voter IDs and voter registrations. We could have planned ahead for our mail-in ballot levels this time around, and we didn't. That was mostly incompetence. Again, I want to be very, very clear. The mistakes in this election, and if there was fraud, the very, very minimal, does not change the outcome of the election. But I would like to have institutions, such as the institutions that run our elections, that people can really, really trust. Because if they could trust them, then there wouldn't be this sort of paradoxical call for our politicians to interfere with them, fix them, do more, solve the problem after the fact. And so, you know, when I look at this fight, I am both sort of shocked at the outlandishness of some of the claims and also find this culmination of the Trump presidency to be, you know, in some ways quite predictable and something that we could have hedged against for the last 4 years by really tightening up and improving our election process.
Nick, you were invoked there. It's always struck me that there's something of a paradox that perhaps you embody or channel, depending on what side of the bed you wake up, what side of the cage you wake up in the morning.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah. Is that on one hand, you know, you and us and we have been celebrating the kind of erosion of BS gatekeeper authority for a long time and the excesses that come with it, the freedom and human trampling policies that frequently come with it. On the other side, the process by which that happens and the end result is frequently that same lack of trust that Catherine points to, which leads to not a very virtuous cycle in statecraft, shall we say. So how do you approach that? And maybe a way of looking at it is like, isn't it striking that 4 years of Donald Trump and like just a constant, almost hysterical pitch of opposition to him and media coverage about him, that the amount of time spent arguing maybe we should give the president less power was infinitesimal. It just like wasn't part of the anti-Trump argument. Talk, Nick Gillespie.
There was that, you know, maybe that 2 week period after Trump won and before he was inaugurated where a bunch of liberals said, you know, maybe we made a mistake by celebrating Barack Obama's extensive use of executive orders and executive actions. And then that went away. Because I think people very quickly thought, well, we're going to get it back. So why would we want to diminish this power or whatever? I think that's the root of this dynamic where there is no question that authorities of all sorts, whether you're talking about the Catholic Church, whether you're talking about Volkswagen or, you know, the United Way as a nonprofit, and certainly government and media and whatnot, they suffer from a loss of authority or being authoritative because they have been caught time and time again lying, overstating what they know to be true, et cetera. And what we need to end this cycle of less and less confidence and trust in institutions and authorities is for authorities, I think, to admit that they don't know as much as they say, or to only state that which they know with strong you know, strong evidence and then to admit errors. And that has not happened in the government. It doesn't generally happen in the media. It doesn't happen in the Catholic Church. It doesn't happen, you know, et cetera. And that's the shift that we haven't done to move to what I would consider, you know, actually a very, you know, a more postmodern world where we realize that truth claims are less exacting and more provisional, that there are many more sources and ways of talking about things and being authoritative, and just kind of owning the fact that we have to live in a world of epistemological humility, to kind of pull it back to a Hayekian insight. And that is, you know, it's a real problem. And unfortunately, you can already see in the time between Trump, you know, effectively being vanquished, he'll be the last one to acknowledge, if he ever does, that he lost the election. But you can already see in the way people are pumping up Joe Biden and shutting down or trying to shut down criticism of his past record or his future picks and things like that. So I don't think we're there yet. And that'll be, I think, an essential role for reason in the coming 4 years, as it was in the last 4 years, of kind of calling bullshit on people who are making claims that are, you know, likely not true or vastly overstated.
Peter, like you to address the broad topic and perhaps with a little twist, since Nick said the word epistemological, and look, I pronounced it correctly.
Good work.
I forget exactly when it started, but our former colleague Julian Sanchez, you know, a long time ago, talked about the epistemic closure of the then kind of American journalistic right, kind of media right. What is your assessment, Peter, since you have been adjacent to the kind of your generation of center right journalists for a long time? How would you assess how they have responded to the last 3 weeks of Trumpian election challenges?
I mean, I think the thing that I really love about this is that the lawyers involved here, you know, including Sidney Powell, were being referred to by Trump as the elite strike force. That, like, that's the team that he put together for his elite election fraud strike force. I think there's a couple of things going on here that are worth pointing out. One is you talked about the reaction on the right, and a bunch of it is built around an argument that isn't quite defending Trump's legal claims, but is instead saying that, well, they're justified, and they typically point to the Russia investigation into Trump and into his dealings with or connections to Russia. And the argument boils down to, well, the Russia investigation was total horseshit, and Democrats wasted 4 years on an unfounded and speculative theory about Donald Trump and the 2016 election. So therefore, Republicans should now be justified in wasting their own time and energy on unfounded and speculative theories that are obviously horseshit. It's a completely specious argument that I don't think actually does the work that the people making that argument want it to do. As for Trump and his team, look, there's something about this that's really fitting. They are, for the most part, not really trying to make a strong and plausible legal case. This is just about spreading doubt and undermining the kind of the legitimacy of Joe Biden's win. Now, that's what Trump does. That's what he did even in 2016 when he won. And in one way, it's totally clownish. In another way, it's kind of dangerous. Catherine said something that I thought was actually useful here, which is that this is in some ways quite predictable. I would say that it's just fitting. It's really fitting that Trump is going to go out on this note with actions that are dividing even his critics, because you've got some folks saying, well, this is an apocalyptic threat to democracy. And you've got other people saying, look, we can basically ignore this. It's bad, but it's a total clown show. It poses little real danger to our electoral system. And to me, I think in a lot of ways, it's both. The peaceful and mutually agreed upon exchange of power after an election is in many ways the most important aspect of maintaining a free and open democracy. And Trump is doing his damnedest to undermine that, as he always does, as he has done throughout his presidency. But he's also doing it in the dumbest and most just sort of stupid and lazy possible way. And that's the Trump presidency in a nutshell.
We could talk about this for a lot longer, and we probably will at some point. But I wanted to wrap a bow on it just by pointing out, Peter, that you should not, generally speaking, say with surprised tone in your voice that Catherine said something actually useful. I think that's not strategy for success long term.
I wasn't surprised.
I surprise myself occasionally by saying something useful. It's totally fair.
I wasn't surprised at all by that. I merely meant to call attention to a particularly useful.
Just kidding, because it's funny. Let's go to our end of podcast. Things that we have been consuming. I will start with Nick.
Oh, my pick this time around is a wonderful book called Listening to Ecstasy by a therapist named Charlie Wininger. It's subtitled The Transformative Power of MDMA. And Charlie he's 70, 71 years old. He's been a therapist for about, 30 years now. And it's part memoir and part kind of manual of how to use ecstasy to, you know, kind of live a better, richer, more fulfilling emotional life as well as kind of mental life. It's a tremendous document of kind of drug culture over the past 50 years, but also shifts that are happening in therapy, because MDMA, of course, is in stage 3 trials with the FDA that are being pushed by MAPS, the group led by Rick Doblin. And it is, you know, there was in therapy in particular, starting in the 1980s, there was a shift away from psychodynamic theories to psychopharmacological explanations. You know, there's the rise of SSRIs, and a lot of new psychotherapeutic drugs came on the market. MDMA, which was legal until the mid-60s and then was banned, is making a comeback as something that is very useful for people both within a conventional therapeutic setting as well as in a more relaxed way to kind of really get to know yourself and kind of work through a lot of stuff. And Listening to Ecstasy is a wonderful read if you're interested in that kind of stuff, whether you use this stuff or not. It is just it's a milestone, or it's a marker along the way to, again, to go back to what I was saying before, a post-prohibitionist America where we open up our pharmacopoeia to a lot of different substances to be used in ways that are very intentional and very directed. And once we get to a legal framework where we can actually talk about these things and sell them in, you know, kind of openly and with regulated, you know, both self-regulated and even government regulated situations, we'll all be a lot better off.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
So I don't know if y'all have heard, but all of journalism is now just emailed newsletters. That's all that's left of journalism as of this week. We, of course, had the substackification of Vox this week. So Matt Iglesias has fled to Substack. Ezra Klein has fled to the New York Times. And, Lauren Williams to just like lay down somewhere with a cold cloth over her eyes probably for a while. I'm not actually sure.
She's starting a new journalism
venture.
Sure, yeah.
Aren't we all? And so I want to highlight a Substack that is a complement to conventional and traditional journalism. That is the Cocktails with Suderman Substack that launched this week. I am not getting this was not a paid placement. I do not need to put any disclaimers on here. Peter will, of course, be continuing all of his excellent work at Reason. But if you happen to enjoy a good Suder monologue, and you happen to enjoy a good cocktail, and you happen to maybe be sad that you can't go to a bar to get one of those, or if you are me, that you can't go to Suderman's house to get one of those made for you, then you might be interested in this Substack, which is a newsletter about how to make cocktails at home. And it is also, with each one comes sort of some cocktail recipes, but also a long riff about structure. I'm just guessing that's going to be literally all of them, but it's at least the first one, and it's pretty good. It's pretty delightful. So sign yourself up. I think I'm like a, lifetime on the rocks member or something, but you can be a monthly member or an annual member as well. So Cocktails with Suderman, a Substack that isn't part of the breakdown of traditional journalism.
Beautiful. Suderman, follow that up.
I've been playing a video game, Call of Duty Black Ops Cold War. So I've talked about how I play Call of Duty most years and have for about a decade or so. It's the kind of preeminent competitive multiplayer shooter series. It comes out every year around this time of year. Call of Duty games are typically divided into basically two components that matter. There's the multiplayer, which is the competitive online experience, the typically team-based, and then there's the single-player campaign. There's also a zombies mode that I basically ignore. And the single-player this year is kind of interesting to reason folks, because it is set in the early 1980s against the backdrop of America's Cold War conflict against communism. You start by going on a mission through the streets of, I don't know what, I think European, like dingy European city, and you've got all these like great, like early 80s leather jackets going on, and it's really sort of, you know, it just like gets the vibe of like undercover, you know, spy, like lethal spy work really well. And you're going after some sort of Iranian agent or something. And then after the first mission, you are tasked by none other than Ronald Reagan himself, who strolls into the room and says, "Hey, basically, go kill a bunch of people for me." And one of the, like, there's like some functionary, it doesn't matter, he's just like a nerd in a suit. And he's like, "Wait, Mr. President, don't you know that all of this stuff is illegal?" And then like your team busts into a like a, "Everything we do all the time is illegal." And Ronald Reagan is just like, "That's great. We're preventing an attack on the free men and women of the world. Who cares if it's illegal? Just go do it." My friend Sonny Bunch wrote a column about this for the Washington Post. He is he's more neoconservative than I am, I think it's fair to say. And he just wrote a piece about how much fun it was to do war crimes for Reagan.
Yeah. Speaking of 1940s radio entertainers, that's who I have been listening to. I'm on the eternal search for useful artists to say shuffle songs by. I was hanging out for an extended time with my 5-year-old yesterday, trying to get her to make the phone not ring, and also to
is that a landline?
Yes.
Woo, Grandpa.
Grandpa does radio spots here, fellas.
I mean, Mama does radio spots too, but she don't have no landline.
Anyways, I needed to bribe the 5-year-old with entertaining music that she might like, so that we could clean the house together. And for that purpose, I highly recommend shuffling songs by Spike Jonze with the S. All longtime listeners of the Dr. Demento show from back in the day will be fully fluent in.
I don't think he was really a doctor, Nick. Matt.
Obviously.
He was a doctor as much as Dr. Jill Biden.
What relationship, if any, does the musical
which I guess is
Spike
all that
Jonze
counts in Biden's
with
America.
An S have to the director of Being John Malkovich?
And a photographer of Matt Welch. My Instagram or Facebook or one of my avatars is a photo that Spike Jonze took of me. So you...
And he took that name after Spike Jonze. He would not have called himself Spike Jonze if the earlier
absolutely
Spike
correct.
Jonze had not existed.
That Spike Jonze was an appreciator of great old art. And this Spike Jonze was a super accomplished, like, big band leader in the 30s and 40s who just decided to become, you know, Captain Silly Pants. And so, like, every just awful kind of... like kind of radio noise you could ever imagine. His most famous for
Biggest hit in 1942. He was about farting in Hitler's face. And I'm not even kidding. You know, the Hitler says to Führer, "We are the master race." So we Heil, right in the Führer's face. Gigantic 1942 hit. Makes you proud to be an American and to do war crimes for Reagan and other people. But very, very funny. About 1 hour is your limit before you start getting tired of like radio sound gimmicks. But really funny, witty, cornball music. And it awakens the Kraken in 5-year-olds.
So I absolutely can never let my son hear
but
that.
But does it put like, the Kraken on steroids?
Allow that little ditty that you just performed to come into my house because it will be the soundtrack of my life henceforth.
He is going to hear it at a friend's house and then he's going to come home and ask you to buy him the biggest set of speakers that exists so that he can play it constantly.
It'll be like Adderall for hyperactive kids, Catherine. It'll actually lull them to sleep.
It might actually calm him
down.
That
is the only thing that carried us through the dark days of World War II.
By farting in Hitler's face.
Between that and Bugs Bunny kicking, giving a hot foot to Tojo and stuff like that. This was what kept us going.
Speaking of kept us going, let's kick us out of here. And thank you all for listening and listen all week, this truncated Thanksgiving week. And again, happy Thanksgiving to you all. And please give us your own coping strategy in the comments, which we're going to definitely read this time on the site. Listen to our reason.com/podcasts to get your fill of the Wednesday interview with Nick Gillespie and the Friday Soho Forum debate series and such. And again, send us your questions for the webathon podcasts@reason.com, group, individual, and whatever. And we'll catch you again next week. Thanks. Goodbye.